Good morning and welcome to our program, Our American Heritage. I am your host, Arch Hunter, and it's our desire at American Heritage to explore in depth the American experience from its beginning to the present. Understanding the history of this great nation is paramount in understanding our greatness. And so today we're pleased to welcome back as a very special guest, Stephen Pierce. Stephen, welcome back and thank you for coming back to the program.
I am so excited to continue this conversation. Thank you.
Well, since you called me the man, I'm excited to listen to you even more. Stephen grew up in Haverford Township and went to Haverford High School, is a graduate with a bachelor's degree and master's degree from LaSalle University. Stephen and I worked together at the Paoli Battlefield Preservation Trust for several years now, 3 or 4 years. And I have watched Stephen do his work as a reenactor / interpreter, and I've been amazed at the work he does and is doing. And so I've asked Stephen to come on and share with our listeners two programs, and he just finished the first program, and he was talking about the reenacting background. So Stephen, share with our listeners again what you have to do to become a good interpreter, because you just don't show up, you know, and do something. There's a lot of background. So share with our listeners, please, and then continue on with your discussion with us, please.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I forgot to mention with the previous bit is that definitely go to a reenactment, go to a living history event first before you even buy anything and invest and talk to people at those historic sites, because talking to those people, you really want to feel them out, especially if you're joining like a regiment of soldiers. You want to find out if that's a good feel around there, because my first the first group I was part of, the 84th Highlanders, I got along with them for the first couple of reenactments, but then things happened and it kind of petered out. And that's fine. You're going to probably have that. That's what happens when you work with any group of people. It might not mesh. But I think talking to people is definitely great. What's even better is actually trying to find a local group that you can mesh with, because you have, you know, very similar interests in, you know, historic sites, historical battles, talking. So that's really great. And also, maybe I always say be a part of some kind of local historic site, volunteering efforts. I've always thought that is a great way to kind of get your foot in the door with that. And especially if it's like a smaller historic site, like for me, another big historic site I worked around is my church, St. Paul's Lutheran in Ardmore. And that has a long history, because we started in 1765, and then later on a church was built. And reason I got into living history is actually interpreting a lot of people who were buried there and giving tours. We had a very famous messenger in Washington's army named Jacob Latch. We have also this guy from the War of 1812 named Colonel William Peachin. He was the publisher of this little pamphlet that a guy made named Francis Scott Key, and it was called the Defense of Fort McHenry, which ended up becoming the national anthem. So he was known as the publisher of the Star-Spangled Banner. So we have all these really interesting characters, and you know, if you're a part of house of worship anywhere, or some place that has good history around it, I guarantee they would love someone to potentially dress up or be a tour guide for those places. It just adds, again, another dimension to the historic site. It garners a lot more attention, and it also helps with social media presence in a lot of these other historic sites. So,
and Stephen, do you do particular individuals like Noah Lewis does, or are you more very broad in your presentation?
It just depends on who the place I'm in. Most of the time I am doing broad soldier life. There's so many people that just kind of, there's a lot of people that really like the common soldier of the Continental Army. And I love doing that because I have ancestors who were in the Continental Army. But now I am starting to kind of branch out and trying to do more individuals. I'm actually working on a couple right now. A lot of people now really love civilian occupations. Mm-hmm. They love what people did back in the day. There's this really great interpretation that this group does of how people basically got into the poorhouse in colonial America and how they got out of the poorhouse. And it's just so fascinating, like what all of these different individuals in colonial America did as occupations. It's very jarring too, which is really, really interesting. But yeah, one of the interpretations I'm working on is actually a guy named George Morgan. He was a Philadelphia merchant who spoke fluent Lenape, and he became the main diplomat between the Continental Congress and the Lenape and Delaware nations. And it ended up getting pretty bad towards the end, but just knowing, like, learning about that aspect of the American Revolution is so fascinating. And I love this guy's story, and he's kind of forgotten. So I really like to, I would love to kind of keep on making his story more bigger and broader to the American public. I'm trying to think of what else, but well, yeah, there's a whole bunch of other ones. I got one really special coming up, but I don't want to spoil it. So
okay. last year at Paoli Battlefields Heritage Day, Stephen, you were doing some talks and demonstrations with the musket and gunpowder. Could you share any of that possibly with our listeners? Because the knowledge that you have about that, I just found amazing. That there are so many things that I wouldn't even think of that you were sharing.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, one of the things that I love about the Heritage Day and everything is we have that military timeline, and we go through not only all the different uniforms of the people back in the day, but all the different kind of armaments that they had. And I kind of started first using the Brown Bess musket. There was basically three different guns that won the American Revolution. There was the Brown Bess, which was British, and that was probably the most widely distributed weapon of the American Revolution because most, you know, Americans were British subjects, so they had those. The Pennsylvania rifle, which became very unique on the battlefield, and the Charleville, which was French, that later came over. The way we load, you know, guns and stuff like that today is pretty much nothing like the way they did back in the day. A good soldier could get around 3 to 4 shots off in a minute. Shots off in a minute. Nothing like what happens on the battlefield today with actual assault rifles and stuff like that. And the processing of loading became just a part of the training back in the day, with putting the powder, which again, you have this cartridge in your hand that has powder, ball, and tow in it. And the powder would go into the pan area, which you had to put like a little fingernail of powder in. Then you put the rest of the powder into the barrel with the tow. Now, tow is kind of like a very flammable, kind of almost paper/wiry material. And that ignited the flame within the barrel when you hit the flint with the pan to shoot the bullet out. And the bullets back in the day were massive. They were around 50 to like 75 caliber bullets. So they just did massive devastation on the battlefield when you actually hit something. Mm-hmm. But a lot more people in the American Revolution died from disease than they did from actual gunfire on the battlefield because of just the amount of space it took to fire from one spot to the other. And Washington really wanted to use these smoothbore guns, unlike the rifle guns, because they did a lot more massive damage and had a bigger rate of fire than the rifles did.
Mm-hmm. Where did you obtain your knowledge about how to load a musket, you know, how to take it apart, all those things? Because it's labor intensive to fire one. Where did you obtain all the knowledge to be able to do that and then share it with the audiences?
Absolutely. Yeah. So for getting the musket, there is definitely, it's not that hard anymore. It was a little bit harder back in the day. But you can actually get a musket through the mail nowadays. There's, I think, a law, basically, it was after the JFK assassination that said that you couldn't buy any weapon online that was later than 1898. So muskets are not considered real firearms and stuff like that. So you can actually get it from Pedersoli, muzzleloaders.com, kind of stuff like that. But you can also find them on other markets. But the way I learned how to fire and load is actually a combination of fantastic YouTube demonstrations. There are guys like a guy named Brandon F. who goes through all of these like reenactorisms, basically stuff that's, you know, not true. But he also goes through how to load the musket on the battlefield, which is incredible. We have these manuals from the 18th century that still show you how the proper ways of loading a musket and cleaning a musket. Townsend's, which is also known for selling colonial stuff, they have a bunch of good videos on taking care of your musket. And again, forums are great. There are so many great forums online to show how to clean your musket. And the great thing about cleaning the musket is that you don't really need a lot of modern stuff to clean it with. I clean my musket with what a lot of people used back in the day, and that is basically olive oil. olive oil and brick. It's crushed up brick with olive oil. You mix it together and it gets a lot of the corrosion mm-hmm. and black powder stuff on the musket. There's also bear oil, that's what it was called, and that's expensive. But you don't really need that. No, olive oil and brick dust. I'm like, wow, this is awesome. Yeah. You don't have to buy any kind of crazy, lubrication or stuff like that you need for modern guns and stuff like that. So it's a unique challenge, but it's a labor of love. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. You feel like you're actually doing something like that,
And listeners, if I would watch Stephen doing his interpretations, you could tell it's a labor of love because there's a tremendous amount of excitement in what he does and sharing the knowledge that he has with audiences, and you can see them come alive. Stephen, name some of the other places where you have been able to do reenacting. You mentioned Fort Mifflin and Paoli. What are some of the other places where you, and I'm sure there's a lot of places where you've been.
Oh yeah, I've been to tons of places, and still have more to come. But I try to do as many around here as possible. I actually had never been to this place until this year, but Hope Lodge, mm-hmm. All the way up in the White Marsh territory. That is just like this forgotten battle, it's not the original place where the battle took place, but the mansion that was there and the little small battle that took place in the region is very fascinating. I was very glad I was able to go to that event for the first time. And Brandywine Battlefield, of course. Now, they don't have consistent battle reenactments each year. They usually try to do it every like 5-10 years or so. But that is always a wonderful time and a mm-hmm. big event. Oh my gosh, last year,
it was huge.
It was the 245th anniversary. It was like Gettysburg.
It was.
I couldn't believe how gigantic that got. So the 250th anniversary of that, that's going to be exciting stuff. Trying to think what else. Valley Forge always has a couple of events, but because that's National Park, it's a little bit harder for them to do bigger interpretations and reenactments. But a lot of these little houses as well, like where I work at a Harriton House.
Yes, yeah.
There was a small battle that actually took place in that area, more in the Madsen's Ford, Cotchahockin area, but it was called the Battle of Madsen's Ford, and I'm actually doing some research on that currently for the house. And basically, it was this little scouting party of Pennsylvania militia, and they were doing, scouting stuff and burning bridges and stuff to stop the British from getting to Washington. And this little force of 200 to 300 Pennsylvania militia smashed into Cornwallis's like main army of like 2,000 to 3,000 British. So it didn't end up well for the militia. But oh my gosh, there's just all these little hidden places around here, and I'm hoping with the 250th we elevate them and really get people to invest in them. I'm trying to think where else. Fort Mifflin, of course, we've talked about that, and New Jersey, if we go right across the river, New Jersey has all these places like Princeton. We're going to do that again this year for my regiment, and that's a great reenactment. The Crossing, Trenton.
Have you done Fort Mercer?
Yes, I have done Fort Mercer. Fort Mercer is different and a little difficult because there is actually no structure in that area. I would love if they could somehow make that little. It was actually a little wooden fortification. Mm-hmm. I would love to see if they could recreate that. But I have not done that reenactment yet. But that is a gorgeous area. The side of the river is gorgeous.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. And
Stephen, do you know approximately how much money that you have put into the different outfits that you wear and the equipment and the brown vest? You have any idea, or don't you want to think about that?
I might need another PPE loan to cover all that. I would say for my first outfit, I definitely know I probably spent with the outfit, you have the linen shirt, you have the waistcoat, you have the main coat, you have the hat, and you have the shoes, and of course the musket and the other accessories. Now the good thing about I had a little bit easier than a lot of other people because at Fort Mifflin, I actually was provided with shoes, and that was huge, and I was provided with a couple of other things. But in total, my first outfit was definitely probably around $2,000 or something like that, $2,000 to $3,000. It is just so much money. But again, if you're going to go into this, you got to just focus on the one initially, then you can kind of branch out a little bit. But it's like that first outfit, if you want it nice, that's what it's going to be. But again, if you're going to just do little things for your local historical society, I'm actually writing kind of like a piece that talks about good, better, and best in regards to what to, where you can buy and stuff like that. And when you like, there's more affordable places nowadays that are making it a lot more easier. Like South Union Mills, they're a place out in Tennessee, and they make amazing reproduction stuff for a great price. Townsend's will always give you, you know, kind of a bare bones. You know, they're really not the best, but if you want, again, if you're doing like a tour or something like that, they're always great for bare bones, and you won't spend nearly as much as much as that kind of stuff. But no, it's all, if you want good stuff, it's going to be handmade. Sure. Hand tailored, yep. like it was. But these are forms of art that are just dying. And when you're buying lost art and dying art, you're going to pay a good price for it. So,
of all the experiences that you have, do you have any interesting questions that you have been asked above others?
Oh my gosh, yeah. When it comes like the best event I've been to, most unique events and stuff like that. You know, there's so many great events. I'm really trying to think. I mean, the first time you ever do like a reenactment at a place you've never been to, it's definitely kind of an exhilarating thing because you're learning new things, you're getting tours, you're interacting with new people. The first time I actually ever did, was that my first reenactment? Yes, it was my first reenactment ever with the Highlanders. I was at Germantown. And that was a great event because it was just so invigorating. This is like, I've shot the musket before, but then they were training me and everything else like that, and it was exhilarating. And even as you are, and I wanted to add this in as well, is that even when you're using a musket and you're not firing, you know, live ammunition at someone else, safety is just so important. And I think when you first get in there and you're doing it, for the first time, you want to be as safe as you possibly can. Sure. I actually cut myself on a piece of flint really badly. So I had a hand bandage over my hand, and they were like, "Well, that you're looking the most authentic out of anyone here because you're actually drawing real blood here."
You're drawing blood.
You're drawing blood. And but again, it's just, and because so many accidents can happen. I mean, you cannot do a reenactment in the United States of America unless you have insurance. Right. I mean, that is such a big thing because things can go haywire. I mean, I think in Civil War reenactments, which is a totally different ball game than Revolutionary War reenactments, I mean, they take that stuff so intense. There was an instance in which some guy apparently still thought that he wanted the South to rise again, and he put live ammunition in his gun, and he actually shot someone on the battlefield.
Yep.
And it was like, that was shocking. I couldn't believe that happened. But yeah, no, you just got to be careful. Like, we don't even pull out our ramrods in reenactments in America, because there was this instance of some guy forgetting to pull his ramrod out of the gun.
And there it goes.
Do you have
a particular aspect or part of the revolution that you favor more than another part of the revolution?
Oh man, this is like asking like what your favorite child is. I really don't. I mean, I love just Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Revolutionary War history, because I feel like, and I've talked to someone about this a couple of months ago, and I think it still sticks today, because the way we teach the revolution in schools nowadays, it is so geographically centered differently. Like, think about it. You go from, you know, right after the French and Indian War to around 1770, it's all about Boston. It's all about Boston and Massachusetts area. You don't talk about the other colonies. And then when it gets to like 1776, you talk about the Second Continental Congress. You talk about the Philadelphia campaign and all this other stuff. So we're going down and we talk about the Mid-Atlantic area. And then towards the end of the war, we talk about like the Southern campaign. So I just found it very interesting how geographically we go from north to south. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just the way you basically just tell, you get all the aspects of the story, which is great. But I try to tell people about like what was going on here, what's going on there. Like, we have, again, the 250th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party coming up, which is going to be really cool. But people don't know that the first ever protest against the Tea Act in America was in Philadelphia.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was in Philadelphia, and Benjamin Rush wrote to, I think, John Adams about it, saying, like, yeah, we were the first one to start that stuff. And Adams was like, oh, okay. You know, like,
is it true that was the beginning of the notorious Philadelphia Eagles fans with that first –
Yes, exactly. That's the whole, no one likes us and we don't care. That's how we started that whole thing.
That's exactly the way it is.
But the first petition for against the Tea Act, yeah, that was in Philadelphia. Our Tea Party happened after the Boston Tea Party, but that was even different too. There was tea parties all across the country. There was one led by like all women in North Carolina or something like that. Mm. So I just tell people all the time, like, this was such a united effort. Mm-hmm. And all of the different things that, you know, happened, it also happened in your backyard. Like if you were in the 13 colonies, sometimes even out of the 13 colonies, there is some sort of Revolutionary War history there. See, now, if you're California, that might be a little
that's
different.
That's a whole different. Yeah, they have a whatever out there. We have so much of our history, and so much is written, obviously, about the Civil War. Do you find that in the last 10 years, 15 years, we're having a whole renaissance and a reawakening to the American Revolution?
Yes. I actually do think that is actually happening, which is great. I think that what's happening is that so much more research is coming out. I have never seen so many books and ideas about the American Revolution that I have seen in my entire life. I mean, just topics that you would never think about and people you never think about. And I think just people just, again, having a new renewed interest in this because of the 250th of the country. And I think people were kind of let down by the bicentennial, that they kind of want this to work. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're going to succeed or not, because I think state governments aren't kind of doing enough to prepare themselves for this whole thing, and even the national government. But it's going to be interesting. But when it comes to actual written stuff, I think it's going to be great. The only thing that really needs to happen is if there's going to be, you know, movies and TV shows. Right. And I know Ken Burns is making a big PBS series about the American Revolution, which could renew a lot of interest. But yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. I think in the past 10 years, there has been a whole lot more historiography. Yeah. That is the word. Yeah.
Well, listeners, we want to thank, and I want to thank Stephen for your dedication to what you do, for the time and education that you put into what you do, the monetary value of what you put into what you do to help educate all of us Americans. It really is an honor for me to know you, to be a member of the Paoli Battlefield with you, to know what we do there, and to see your dedication to your country. And to see the love of your country, to be able to, so that you want to share some of that knowledge that you have with fellow citizens. So, you know, thank you for everything that you do. At least when there's the dedication of reenactors. It's phenomenal to see and what they do and what their background is and what they have to do to get to a certain historical location to be able to do that reenactment. It's an arduous thing, but it's a labor of love. So, Stephen, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I really, and I appreciate all the work you're doing. This is the kind of, you know, talking to other people, you know, trying to get people engaged. That is just as important as what the reenactors do. And that's what you're doing right here. I mean, I keep telling this to people. It's all a collective effort. It
Absolutely.
Is never a one man job. You know, I love our individuality in this country, but it is nothing when we can't collectively talk about the people of the past, talking about the sacrifices of the past, and talking about all those things in between. Those are the big things.
Absolutely. So thank you. Mm-hmm. So again, Stephen, thank you for coming and sharing so much of your background and knowledge and on what you do and your dedication to what you do. So continue on. You do a marvelous job. I appreciate your enthusiasm and your knowledge about and your dedication to what you do. So again, we want to thank you for not only sharing on the program, but also for what you do as a reenactor or a reenactor interpreter. And I'm sorry that, you know, you had to experience Haverford High School. I wish you could have experienced, you know, the Fighting Tigers of Marple Newtown. So
it's okay. As Nathaniel Green said it, we get hurt, we come back up, and we fight again, or
and
something
we
along
fight
those
again.
Lines.
Something like that. So,
something like that.
So again, Stephen, thank you so much for sharing with us. We certainly appreciate it. This is 1180 AM WFYL, Working for Your Liberty.